Hello out there to all you Metsian folk. This is Sam Maxwell on a beautiful evening on the Metsian podcast. It really is crystal clear on the island of Manhattan. Beautiful day in Metsville, beautiful off day in Metsville. And we're going to have a great time with our featured guest who will be joining us very shortly, the great Greg Prince of Faith and Fear in Flushing. But before we bring him on, let me welcome one of my co-conspirators for the evening. Unfortunately, Rich Sparago cannot be here, but he is always here one way or another, so holler out there to Connecticut. Mr. Mike LaColant over in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, what is going on? I'm guessing it's this crispy, lovely, lovely summer, early summer evening, even though it's still technically spring, out in Brooklyn right now.
Today was an outstanding day weather-wise. The last 2 days were rather brutal. Hello, Sam. Hello, Metsville. Otherwise, a good day. We have an off day. Gives us time to talk Mets.
Yes, it does. And without further ado, let me welcome on a man who needs no introduction, but I will give him one. He is the proprietor of Faith and Fear in Flushing, along with Jason Fry. They alternate games over there. He's also written a book titled Faith and Fear in Flushing, as well as many other books that I will let him get to in a moment. But also, he was featured in my documentary on the Mets fan, The Newest Breed, that can be found on YouTube. Little quick shameless plug. Greg, welcome as always.
Good evening, fellas. Good to be here.
So let's get right to it. The New York Mets, the first place New York Mets, you know, everybody likes to call them the mob squad. The bench mob, excuse me. But
mob squad, actually. That's good.
Right? we dropped it on here. We'll have to run with it some later. But what I want to focus on is that it really at this point can almost be called the AAA squad, the AAA mob.
Well, you could spell squad with three A's, I suppose. Listen, these guys were not projected to be the starting lineup for the first place team in the National League East, but they are. A little bit of that, I suppose, is a function of mathematics, that the Mets have played fewer games, have fewer losses as a result, but the winning percentage is there. And, you know, these guys are doing the job and are a very rootable bunch. I suppose anybody in first place would come off as a rootable bunch. But these guys who were not in your preseason previews, who were, you know, whether you are one of those types who likes to buy a preseason magazine in January when trades are still being made, or who take seriously any kind of a preseason preview that runs on the eve of the season. Life has changed many times over, and not, from an injury standpoint, it's not good, but from a result standpoint, it's been okay.
They just are holding on, and Mike, you know, when you think about what you've seen from this team and considering that at some point they're going to have to make these games up, and they're going to have to make these games up within the division. You're holding as much confidence as I am based off of everything you've seen. You know, they're going to have their ugly loss here and there, but when they need to win and when they need to hold on to that first place lead, they continue to do so, even with the Billy McKinneys and the Drurys and the Mason Williams of this beautiful Mets world we're living in right now.
Indeed. They're flirting with par. They're still feeding off that 7-game win streak and another 5-game winning streak. That's why we're still in first place. But as you say, what a resilient bunch. Look, we always say it takes a 40-man roster to win, and you know, this is evidence of that. The team broke down early. Hopefully there'll be a return to health hopefully by the dog days of summer. And that just might give us a leg up on the competition. Our regular starters will be a little bit more fresher, you know, and our backups can go back to their previous mission statement, and everyone will benefit from, you know, normalized playing time when you compare to what the competition has going for them. I mean, they're not struggling with injuries as much as we are at the present moment, but they're struggling nonetheless. And it's a good day in June that we're talking about the Mets being in first place. You think back to April, we struggled somewhat. We had a good May, and we're still feeding off of that. We're 4-4 in June. We've known what type of month can be in Metsville, so let's see if we can try to avoid that. These guys are just playing hard. They have a lot of spirit. They're unified, and I think that takes, you know, teams a long way. Unification takes teams a long way. There's a camaraderie amongst them, and there's something to that. Don't let people, you know, try to make you think otherwise.
I agree, and we're seeing it front and center. And before we get into the machinations of the contrast of ownership, Greg, I believe, you know, I'd have to look it up, but you can remind me whether we've had you on how many times. I think we've at least we've had you on either once or not at all this season, but definitely not recently, and definitely not at this particular as we've settled into all these players. And I almost called him Brian Drury, but of course his name is Brandon Drury. I had to look it up just to make sure. Greg, tell us what you've seen overall, like you know, both overall and also get as specific as you want. What have you loved about these New York Mets? And please, name names.
You know, you have to love the way they've gelled as a team. They could be a bunch of rented strangers. We've seen teams, you know, the Met uniform doesn't necessarily fit that well on guys who kind of come in, come out, fill in, and then are sent on their way. But this is a group that has coalesced, that seems to enjoy one another's company, which I don't know how important that is. We can all cite legendary teams that fought with each other as much as they fought the competition. But, you know, these guys seem to take to each other as if, you know, they had spent, you know, 6 weeks in Port St. Lucie together and then, you know, shared cabs and gone to dinner and all that great cliche stuff. From a substantive standpoint, you know, I'll name a name, Billy McKinney. I was not familiar with Billy McKinney coming into the moment he was picked up basically out of nowhere. And I'm not going to say I don't miss Michael Conforto, one of the key players on this team, but have you watched a game and said, oh my God, if only Michael Conforto was here, because this guy is doing the job. Kevin Pillar, who, you know, is a folk hero at this point for the way he came back from being hit in the face. He gave his face for the greater good. You know, do you miss Brandon Nimmo not being in center field? You wish Brandon Nimmo were well and getting on base the way Brandon Nimmo does and making nice plays, but no, you don't. And, you go around the horn, you know. Jonathan Villar was, you know, a peripheral player when the season started. Now he's your leadoff hitter and your everyday third baseman. And, again, you're not missing J.D. Davis, except that you wish he was healthy. And when all of these guys theoretically are healthy, you know, the depth between, you know, the guys who are back and the guys who've been holding down the fort is going to be astounding. And, you know, and Mike said before, but a 40-man roster, it has never been truer. So these are guys who you know, they've all been asked to do something very challenging, to step into roles that were not on their radars, where expectations were mostly doubts, if there were expectations at all. And here they are, as we've said, in first place, holding the fort, carrying the torch, whatever swell cliche you want to use. And, you know, much like the weather tonight in the metropolitan area, it's gorgeous.
Well, Mike, let's focus in on Pete Alonso, Francisco Lindor, and James McCann. I think those three, and, you know, Pete Alonso being the younger statesman of the three, but at the same time, I think, you know, we know what type of leadership role he has on this team. And even though it's 3 years, it feels like a very important 3 years. And we can also get into some of the things he's said, which I only have kind of a Cliff Notes version of in my head, but just in terms of sticky substances and something about the free agent stuff. But regarding those three players, they have completely risen to the challenge when it needed to be faced, being the veterans in this lineup right now while people are trying to prove themselves.
Exactly. And the veterans do indeed need to step it up while people remain on the injured list. The onus is indeed on them. It's on Alonso. It's on Dominic Smith. It's on Lindor. And you might include McCann in that. You know, I'm putting the onus on other players before I put it on McCann. But
And thank you, though, because I do mean to mention Dominic Smith, especially since I have his T-shirt from when he was number 22. Dominic Smith has started to come around and has stepped up during this time.
Indeed. But cycling back to McCann, you know, we signed him to be an everyday starter. And I think what we're seeing, he's more accustomed to his former role. And that's not starting every day. You know, we've seen a mix of him and Thomas Nito, and it seems to have benefited the both of them. So I'd like to see how this unfolds in the coming weeks and months. Pete Alonso's funny. He embodies the Mets right now. And what do I mean by that? Winning trumps all. You know, the fact that the Mets are indeed in first place in a couple of games over 500, that's the lead story. Pete Alonso, his performance is coming around. That's the lead story. What he said about baseballs and MLB conspiracy theories at all, you know, right now performance is the lead story. Just like with the Mets, winning is the lead story. Far be it from Met fans to complain, you know. We're not a disgruntled group, are we? But there's plenty of other things that we could be nitpicking about. But, again, performance and winning trumps all. Now, performance-wise, Pete Alonso's coming around. He's got 10 home runs. You know, he's got over 30 RBIs. Once upon a time, a 265 average, well, to those who, you know, average still meant something, 265 is respectable. I don't know how people treat it today. I think he could be doing better, but it is what it is. And he's coming around. Francisco Lindor, I think he's still in adjustment mode, but over his last 10 games, he has multiple hits in five of them. And over the last 10 games, he's hitting .341. So perhaps, you know, his adjustment is going well. And the more games and the more at-bats he has and gets, the better he will become for us. Statistically, yeah, he's struggling a little bit, but he's trending upward. He's trending upward well. So there's something to be said for all three of the individuals you brought up, McCann, Alonso, and Lindor. If it wasn't for their performance, we might be in a lower standing. We know our pitching is carrying us, but you still need to score runs. That's the end game.
Greg, before we get into a bit of a breakdown of the Orioles series, which I'd like to get into, I want to ask you about Pete Alonso, James McCann, Francisco Lindor, and Dominic Smith. You know, especially let's hone in to start on Francisco Lindor. I have been talking about how he had four tools going for him. The one tool he didn't have going for him was the offense, and that is starting to come around.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we pay a lot of lip service to defense, and we talk about especially defense up the middle. You're seeing it. You're seeing it in action, and you're seeing it in a way you haven't seen in a very long time. From a Met shortstop, we've, you know, experienced Met shortstops for the last 10 or so years, you know, trying their darndest and, you know, trying to come along on the job training, that sort of thing, or, you know, guys who were just kind of limited in their range. Lindor just seems to play at a faster velocity than any shortstop I've seen in the modern era on a day-to-day basis. Not necessarily the flashiest shortstop I've ever seen, or, you know, the most acrobatic, take your breath away Ray Ordonez type of thing, but he just, you know, is, you know, just an overused phrase in sports, captain, but he really is the captain of that infield, like the captain of a ship in a way I haven't really, you know, in an on-field way, not just from a, you know, gather around boys and let's have a word of encouragement, but just like a guy who's running the infield. And that to me is, you know, you can't ignore, you know, when the batting average was 170, I understand that, but it's such an important position. And, you know, when you look at defensive runs saved and those sorts of metrics, and suddenly the Mets, who are never anywhere to be seen in those rankings, are near the top. And there's no way that's not a reflection of, first and foremost, of Francisco Lindor as your shortstop. You know, the guy who fascinates me really at the moment is McCann, because McCann was also off to a mostly dreadful start batting, and, you know, sharing time with Nito, which could have been taken as a demotion. Instead, he went to first base when they needed a first baseman, when Alonso was out for a week and a half. And McCann, who played zero games in the major leagues, I'm not sure he'd played any games in the minor leagues, but he'd taken some ground balls and said, okay, that's where you need me. And he played a good first base, and he started hitting. And, you know, combining that with, you know, legitimate defensive skills as a catcher and legitimate play calling or pitch calling skills, and the way he's meshed with Nito as a kind of a two-headed monster, you know, you would have liked to have had JT Realmuto's offense. you wouldn't complain. But right now, McCann, I think, is second on the team in homers. A little bit of a reflection on the team not hitting a lot of homers, maybe, but he's come around, and you understand what you were going after. So, you know, those were the two big position player additions that we did know about, unlike all these others that we were talking about earlier. And as far as Smith and Alonso, I think that those guys have just been a matter of, you know, cold spring and hopefully a hot summer, and signs of it have been coming along. I know you want to talk about Baltimore. I mean, the Mets have, you know, traditionally hit very well in that ballpark. So I would like to see, you know, Alonso keep that up outside of Camden Yards, and, you know, see Smith keep it going at Citi Field as they settle in for a homestand. But, you know, these are young veterans at this point. And, you know, you worry somewhat. You always worry when anybody goes two or three games without a hit. But I don't worry too much about those guys. And the fact, by the way, that Smith has made himself into a legitimate left fielder, as long as we're praising defense.
Yes.
you know, to the point where when you needed a first baseman, I admit I blanched when I thought, why isn't Rojas just putting Smith at first base every day? But he said, you know what, this guy's worked to make himself a left fielder. Let's not, you know, let's not disturb one more position than we have to. And, you know, again, I think that comes back to McCann getting the job done and making that look pretty, you know, the instinct is always to kind of find fault with the manager. Well, you know, the manager did something pretty well there. So it's a good group right now. And not just, it feels funny to say this, usually we say it's not just the stars, it's also the, you know, the subs, the bench guys. Oh, well, you know, we're now at a point where we say it's not just the bench mob, it's not just the fill-ins, it's also, you know, the guys you've heard of. It's also Pete Alonso, don't forget him, that sort of thing. So it's a... you know, it's I guess the funny thing here is that it doesn't feel like it's, quote, all come together, but it's come together enough. And without, you know, getting ahead of ourselves too much, I guess the proof, or at least the interim proof, is going to be, you know, playing the division on a consistent basis in the coming weeks, not to mention some good teams outside the division, but especially the division, because this is your chance to make this lead of about, what is it, 3.5 games, something like that, you know, put some distance out there. Make it real. Make it permanent as it can be, you know, more than a third into a season. So this, you know, you could not have asked for a better first third of a season when you realize that you couldn't have asked for in so many ways, a worse first third of a season from an injury standpoint, a rain-out standpoint, and all the uncertainty that, you know, that they're in good shape. And, you know, it's everybody's doing, basically. That's what it feels like.
You know, Mike, before we break down Baltimore, just to say real quick that it's the kind of stretch that, you know, the Met fan usually doesn't feel good about going into. But right now, you have to say that, you know, there's a reason why the Met fan feels confident right now, even though a lot of different things can happen. But I don't really foresee right now the way they're clicking. I don't foresee, knock on wood, one of those types of second halves, let's say, that we'll be talking about later when we talk about 1978.
Well, every season writes its own story. And I'm not apprehensive about the upcoming games at all. We split four games at San Diego, and they're our next opponent. You know, and then we take on the Cubs. And then back to the... back to our division rivals, you know, Washington on the road, Atlanta at home, Philly at home. That's what you want. You want division games. You want a sense of optimism. And you want hot summer days. That's what we have. And, again, every season writes its own narrative. And here we are, June 10th. Is that what today is? June 10th, yeah. So far, we have a pretty good story going on, you know. So who am I to begrudge, you know, anything else? Sure, we can moan, groan, and complain about injuries and woe is us, but it's just not that way. We just have to be patient and cross our fingers that these guys sustain and continue doing what they're doing and that our division competitors continue to struggle. Because that's part of this equation. We're on top because they're struggling. If they were doing better, the race would be closer, the records would be reflective of that, and we'd be having a different conversation. So, you know, let's. I'm being positive, you know, and I'm usually sometimes just the negative, but I'm cool. I'm cool. I like the continuity of the replacements. I like being able to see them on a daily. These injuries that we're presently having to endure are long-term injuries. So I think I said this two podcasts ago that, you know, this was going to favor the Mets, the fact that our backups, the bench mob, is getting continuous play as opposed to a day here, 3 days off, and a back, a day off, a game, et cetera, et cetera. They're getting regularity, and that's a good thing, and that's probably, you know, helping us along.
I would concur, and Greg, I don't want to necessarily break down exactly these two Oriole games, but use them kind of as a benchmark for the next conversation, and I'm going to start with that first game where David Peterson continues to regress, really. Let's just put it that way. Basically, the back end of the rotation right now, Greg, you can't expect to continue to be in first place with two bullpen games. So this is one of the things that, you know, as we're looking through everything with rose-colored glasses, if we take those off for a second, this is one of those things that the Mets really need to tighten up right now.
Well, no doubt. I mean, I would like to have the rose-colored glasses to the extent of saying you've got such a strong big three in the rotation, a veritable Durant, Harden, Irving of pitching in terms of DeGrom and Walker and Stroman, that anybody else is going to look like kind of a bit player. But, you know, that's stretching it, because we're on a, you know, good turn through the rotation. At most, you have about 4.5 starters, and really, you know, 4 starters mostly, which is to say Lucchesi is about half a starter, and Peterson is half a starter, if that, his last few starts. So that's, you know, that's one place where depth, bullpen depth, has saved them to a certain degree. But, yeah, you can't lean on that twice out of every 5 games. It leaves you no margin for error should Walker or Stroman give you a short start, or if DeGrom leaves with an injury, because I don't see DeGrom otherwise giving you a short start. So, you know, ideally I think you'd send Peterson down and let him find himself. But what are your options? At the moment, nobody that's better. So, you know, you hope that they will continue to work with him. You know, the Oriole game, along with the one before that on the road trip, were steps back. And, you know, it does throw a monkey wrench in momentum if you can't depend on Peterson. Lucchesi, for what it's worth, is, you know, giving you a little more each start. Thing is with Lucchesi is they're not really depending on him to even start a third time through the order. So, you know, that's just asking for trouble in terms of, you know, getting 5 innings or so out of the bullpen, which is just, you know, what was the line from Dean Wormer in Animal House? Son, going through, being fat and stupid is no way to go through life, son, something like that. You know, going through life with starting pitchers that don't give you innings. Going through life with the bullpen pitching 6 innings a game is no way to go through life. So, you know, that is something that needs to be addressed. I think we thought we'd have Carlos Carrasco back by now. And it's clear that, you know, we're in something approaching Jed Lowrie territory in terms of Carrasco's availability. You know, of course, we saw that Jed Lowrie is, you know, perfectly viable major league player again, which is neither here nor there. We're probably not going to be all that patient with a guy we just haven't seen pitch yet. Anyway, you know, we don't have Syndergaard back yet either. We're supposed to have him a little sooner. And I don't think there are teams just kind of giving away pitchers at this point. And we've sort of, you know, shuttled who we can shuttle. I don't know. It's something that bears not only watching and monitoring, but fixing. So it's not like I have a real good answer here other than to say, you know, you want something to not feel great about? Yeah, David Peterson and, you know, I'll leave Lucchese out of it because he's been doing okay. But David Peterson yeah. is a soft spot at the moment, and they're just, you know, not to be too self-evident about this, but there's got to be improvement here. This is a guy we've seen have, you know, very professional, almost dominating outings. So there's something to work with there, and I hope between Jeremy Hefner and James McCann and Ornito and whoever else in the organization works on these things, and that the kid doesn't let down on himself, and that we, you know, don't let down on him, and that, you know, when he is pitching in front of people, you know, I've got to remember, he didn't pitch in front of anybody last year. Nobody played in front of anybody last year, but, you know, if you debuted in 2020, you know, you did not know what it was like to throw in the major leagues or play in the major leagues in front of fans. And I could see, you know, if Peterson's having these sorts of outings at Citi Field, I could see this kind of being a downhill spiral. But let's try to be positive and hope that he starts to find himself again.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that in terms of the fact that, yeah, he debuted last season. And going to Carlos Carrasco, Mike, I'm seeing now that the rehab is not progressing as hoped. Sounds like familiar headlines to Met fans. They'd said that he was starting to throw bullpen sessions, but then this is coming from, by the way, Mike Puma of the New York Post. Bullpen sessions manager Louis Rojas backed away from that comment Wednesday, saying Carrasco hasn't gotten that far. Rojas said Carrasco has been playing catch and clarified to say he previously threw from the slope of the mound. So one way or another, he's not going to come back till July at the earliest, Mike. Maybe he'll come back just in the nick of time, or maybe this will just continue to be one of those things.
Well, if I were the Mets, you know, I would try to see to it that he is healthy by August, you know, August, September. Why rush him? We know he has a history of health issues. I just wish him well. You know, it's not necessarily a Mets issue with me. I just wish him well. I hope he can rebound and recover and return to the mound and help us out. But perhaps the Mets shouldn't hasten it and, like I say, work with him and not put him on any kind of time schedule and just see to it that he returns healthy, hopefully, mid-August by September, help us down the stretch. You know, even the best laid plans go awry sometimes. You know, we're raving about the bench mob and all the fill-ins and all the off-season acquisitions. Well, you know, you can't cover everything. And before I, you know, I'm shying away from criticizing David Peterson. As Greg said, you know, he was a rookie during a pandemic plagued season, and there's something called a sophomore jinx. You know, the plan was for Carrasco to step in. The plan was for Syndergaard to return, perhaps midsummer, and help out. But, you know, that plan is going awry. And I'm not pointing any fingers. I'm not looking to place any blame. You just can't cover everything. I think we're pretty satisfied with the results to date insofar as the off-season acquisitions. You know, but I'm going to ease off David Peterson. He does need some more development in the minor leagues. But it's up to the front office to find their way around that, get somebody else in here. Again, the plan was for Syndergaard and Carrasco, and that plan didn't work out. So before I criticize David Peterson, there are other issues that have, you know, placed the Mets into this condition. So it's up to them to see their way out of it.
You know, this is a good point. I've been saying the same thing in terms of him getting sent down. Here's how I'm looking at this. If you're the Mets and you're looking around the league for reinforcements other than within your system, are you waiting to see, Greg, how this foreign substance thing plays out before you make any rash moves? Hey, Greg, are you there? Mike, do I still have you?
Hello, Sam. I'm sorry.
Hey, Greg.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I had briefly muted because well, I don't want to be heard shouting during the Nets game that I'm trying to watch at the same time. So
before we continue anything regarding the Mets, give us an update on the Nets, please.
The Nets had fallen behind by about 20, and now they are behind by 3 midway through the second quarter. And I am just trying to discern, because I have a sound off. It looks like Kevin Durant had taken a hand to the eye, but he seems to be okay. And it came within a missed 3 of tying the game here. But let me focus back on the question you asked me, which is the original question you asked me, which was rash moves. And what I was saying to nobody, because I hadn't had my volume muted, was I don't know that there are rash moves to be made on June 10th or thereabouts. We know how, even though it's not as many teams as last year, everybody's still a contender for a wild card in June. So I don't know who is available, and if suddenly somebody is available who you want to think a little more closely about because of foreign substances or whatever, I guess that enters the thinking. You know, I don't know that a Max Scherzer playing out his contract and the Nationals falling out of the race conceivably, he suddenly falls in your lap. I don't know that the Nationals are all that anxious to help the Mets. And that's just one name I've heard. So, I'm starting big. I'm starting with a future Hall of Famer here. I'm sure that management is going to keep its eyes open and its ears open. And I would expect you'll have to help me out. The trade deadline, was it moved back permanently to August 31st? I seem to remember that. I don't think it was just last year. But, well, I was going to say July 31st.
Yeah, with no waivers.
Yeah. Whenever the trade deadline is, I can't imagine, much as we've seen 45 different players wear Met uniforms, whether they wanted the Mets to wear 45 different players or not, we're going to see some action by then. And I'm sure as we get closer, there will be some pitching available. I don't know what kind of pitching it'll be. I hope it'll be something that enhances rather than detracts. But I just get the feeling we're too far away from that to start putting names to situations.
Yeah, I would agree. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see the way all of this starts to unfold because by all indications, we should just anticipate another steroid era, but maybe it's just they're just blowing a bunch of smoke. Who knows? Mike, I want to go to the next game and kind of start with the contrast of what was on the other mound, just in terms of from the Mets narrative and seeing Taijuan Walker pitch against Matt Harvey. And seeing basically right now the Mets, possibly get lucky with somebody just coming into his own and not really having had a chance to settle in versus Matt Harvey, who has just completely lost every glimmer of hope that ever existed. It was a very bittersweet game, this 14-1 win. Even though I'm glad we took the W, it was just so glaring the difference. And how, just thinking about it, Matt Harvey went into that first Mets game in Citi Field with a 3.60 ERA, and now it's ballooned to above 7.
It has, and look, we know he's had a difficult career. His body betrayed him. so many injuries. It's unfortunate, you know, and it's rather sad. If you're still emotionally invested in him, what you saw the other night, you know, was hard to watch. As you say, you know, Met fans, he was a big thing here. He really was. And you really don't want to see that. But at the same time, we're Met fans and we're interested in the Mets and what they're doing. And all praise to Juan Walker. What an outstanding effort. And, you know, we have to compartmentalize. Me? Unfortunately, he's just another player whose career got sidetracked by injury. Yeah, he was the Dark Knight. There's a part of me with old school sensibilities who says, you know, he might have considered being a little bit more humble in his younger days. That makes the fall from the mountaintop less tragic and less painful. And watching him in the postgame presser, yeah, that was a little bit depressing. You know, but again, that's why I would suggest being a little bit more humble about your business. That might be an old school sensibility on my part. But, you know, I like my athletes to be a little bit more humble rather than being outspoken, you know. But, again, that's just me. So, you know, Matt Harvey, what can I say? Baseball is just riddled with this very story. The list goes on and on and on, you know. So he's just the latest figure to have to go through that, and it's unfortunate. And I'm sorry. I really am. But I'm no longer emotionally attached to him. And we had this conversation prior to the show, Sam. Perhaps you are, and you feel badly for him, and you feel sorry for him. I'm not there. I'm behind Juan Walker and what's going on in 2021 with the New York Mets. Matt Harvey is in my past. I wish him well. But that's my stance. And if it makes me a bad person, here I am.
Well, I wouldn't go bad person or anything like that. But, Greg, you know, you wrote about Matt Harvey today. And even Matt Harvey on the presser was talking about not being able to make the pitch when he needed to. Which was such a highlight of his career when he first came up. Now, mind you, he's not pitching 98 miles an hour anymore. And that, you know, that can make a presence on the mound great, of course, alone. However, I still think that there's something when you watch him, not only in the presser, but also just generally on the mound now, even with whatever he has now, he could present more domination in terms of personality, in terms of confidence. And that is just so clear in both on the mound and the presser. He's completely lost all of it.
Well, I just want to go on record as saying Mike is not a bad person, regardless of his feelings on any given pitcher. You know, I think the reason I found it difficult to watch the Mets, even though it was the Mets, and I was very happy that they scored 7 runs off the opposing pitcher, and I wasn't given those runs back. I think the reason it was difficult watching them do it against Harvey, aside from the fact that, you know, we have all those golden memories that don't seem that long ago. So I watched Harvey go through this as a Met not that long ago. And I don't even mean not that long ago in the sense that 2013, gosh, it's not that long ago. Well, it's 8 years. But I'm thinking, you know, back in 2017 especially, but also any time, you know, from really the first month of 2016 forward. Specifically, though, if you recall, Harvey came back in September of 2017, after, you know, this wasn't, I mean, the thoracic outlet syndrome was the year before, and he had another injury and missed the middle of that season, came back in September, starting with a start in Houston right after, ironically, Hurricane Harvey. And I don't remember how many starts he had, 5 or 6. And he just got lit up every time. And that was so sad to watch. You know, he was still in a Mets uniform then. It was the end of a very miserable season in general. And to see him basically still being that pitcher, putting up those sorts of numbers, an ERA over 7, was what he was putting up in 2017. And to realize, you know, he's worked this hard and made so many stops since then, just to kind of be back at that. I feel bad for the guy. And obviously, you know, the fact that he was a Met and was the guy who, you know, started the All-Star game and game 5 of the World Series and all that stuff adds into it. But I was thinking about it. You know, the Mets face Zach Wheeler pretty regularly, and I'm fine with the Mets hitting Zach Wheeler all day. And I guess it's because Zach Wheeler, you know, and it's not, you know, I understand he went and signed a really good contract and he's entitled to do that. But, you know, his arc is still near its peak. May have, you know, only found its peak recently. And, he, you know, I wish him well, except, you know, for the fact that he's helping a division rival and all that. Harvey, it's just a different vibe for me. And I guess for a lot of Mets fans, even though, yeah, he was not, you know, he wasn't a keep-your-head-down Steven Matz type of guy, who I also feel, you know, the Mets haven't faced him yet, but I would feel bad if, to a certain degree, if the Mets lit him up to the point where he just seemed helpless, but I would certainly want them to win. You know, Harvey just holds, you know, held a place in, you know, the Met continuum. It was supposed to be Seaver to Gooden to Harvey, basically, and a little detour there, and now we have something, you know, something we had all along, who's, you know, been even better in DeGrom, and, you know, that's great. But, you know, he's just an intriguing character. But I would like to pivot, as Mike said, Taijuan Walker has faced Harvey twice this year and kind of gets lost in the shuffle, at least when I've been watching. You know, he just goes out and gives you 7 innings most nights, most starts. And I won't say it's no effort, but it's just, you know, this guy who just soaks up the game. And you turn around and, you know, it's not quite as spectacular as DeGrom or even Stroman on his best day. But, God, it's just that feeling of he gets the job done. And the pitcher he reminds me of, and it's kind of a strange comparison, but the first year of Citi Field, you might recall, the Mets had LeVon Hernandez, who had been around. And LeVon Hernandez had this one night, I want to say it was against the Nationals, where he threw a complete game, you know, 130 pitches. And even when it was not, you know, even then, you didn't have too many complete games and 130 pitches. But it was just like, it was like watching a gas pump that night. I just remember that, you know, this idea that an old-fashioned gas pump that would keep dinging as you continue to fill up your car, and it just kept going. And that's what, and that was like basically one time with LeVon Hernandez, you know, not counting the rest of his perfectly good career for other teams. That's what Walker reminds me of, but Walker's doing it almost every game. And you just feel so secure when he's out there. Like, it's going to be all right. If he gets a little trouble, he's probably going to get out of it, and he's going to come back for the next inning. And it's not one of these situations we were talking about with, you know, okay, we got to get 6 or 7 innings out of the bullpen. It's fantastic. God, I'm sorry. I'm just reacting to basketball here. You know, this has been a fantastic addition.
Hey,
he was almost
playoff basketball in Brooklyn, man.
Yes, and it's, by the way, the Nets are down 3 at the half, had numerous chances to tie it, didn't quite, but again, they were down 21 at one point, so it's a game. Anyway, you know, Walker was almost an afterthought in putting this team together, and he was certainly a late addition, and he's just been doing the job. And, you know, when he's not facing a ready-made narrative in Matt Harvey, all hats off to Taijuan Walker, And, you know, last night's edition of the Walker Files was pretty typical and pretty instructive. So as long as he stays healthy, he's a guy I don't worry about. And, again, having that kind of confidence and feeling secure goes a long way toward getting you through every 5 days. So, you know, yeah, that's, you know, Matt Harvey will do whatever Matt Harvey does, however long he does it. But for us, the key here is that Taiwan Walker is doing whatever he does, and it's a good thing to watch right now.
I'm so happy before I pass this on to Mike that I found the game. Tuesday, May 26th, 2009, when the Mets were actually still kind of in contention. Levon Hernandez only giving up one run, pitched a complete game, going 4-1 with a 4.28 ERA in the process. At some points I've compared 2009 to this and how some of these names are interchangeable on the rosters, except right now you're actually seeing them perform versus 2009 when none of them did.
Yeah.
Mike, I'll say this before we have to talk about DeGrom and Nation. It's pretty amazing looking back on it and just seeing it in retrospect that DeGrom came up the year that the Dark Knight was on the shelf with Tommy John surgery.
Comparatively speaking, DeGrom came out of nowhere. We were anticipating Harvey's arrival. DeGrom really snuck up on us. You know, coming through the minor league system for Harvey and the hype for DeGrom were incomparable. Whereas it existed for Harvey, it didn't exist for DeGrom. But DeGromination, oh my goodness. Soak it in. Soak it in. That's all I can tell you is just soak it in because these pitchers are rare. He set another record this season, didn't he not? Most strikeouts to start a season, first 50 innings, Nolan Ryan. Massage that one for me and get it correct. I mean, an ERA under one, and here we are in June. That's really good. Let's not forget, you know, all this greatness that we're witnessing. Let's not forget what he achieved. He set that record for most starts with giving up three runs or less. What, 30 starts? He set that record. He's the 11th pitcher in baseball to win back-to-back Cy Youngs. Just the 11th. This level of greatness I'm having difficulty explaining because it's indescribable. I've never seen anybody at this level in my lifetime, and I've seen Tom Seaver, Steve Carlton, you know, a whole bunch of good pitchers. But, you know, it's still relative to the era, but this is unreal. And out of all the talk, speculation, scuttlebutt, and innuendo about sticky substance, Jacob DeGrom's name continues to escape that conversation. Pretty wild stuff.
Well,
you know,
Greg,
pretty wild
the
stuff,
only
man.
Time it's the only time, Greg, that it seems to have come up is just some troll bait on Twitter and the New York Mets. Everybody, all the New York Mets players on Twitter refuted it and kept passing it on to continue to be refuted. And just to also finish also what Mike mentioned, New York Mets right-hander Jacob DeGrom tied Nolan Ryan's major league record for most strikeouts through a pitcher's first five starts of the season, finishing Wednesday night's start with 9 strikeouts over 6 innings to run his 5-game total to 59, April 28th, 2021, from ESPN.com. Greg, you know, I think there's a reason why nobody suspected Jacob DeGrom, and it makes sense. I believe somebody was saying that it was a Dodgers fan who first pointed it out, and with Trevor Bauer kind of at the forefront, and what might be performance art, considering he was the first one to call to blow the horn about all this stuff. Jacob deGrom is just continuing to dominate, and there's no indication that he is doing anything with the ball. And especially people bring up spin rate and how Jacob deGrom is just really fast.
To quote Felix Unger to Dick Cavett in an episode of The Odd Couple, I don't bother my mind with that. I'm not concerned with any troll or any offhand accusation. I'm just enjoying the ride with Jacob deGrom, and it's been a long ride. There was the half of the ride that was just, you know, very, very, very good, and then there's the otherworldly part that we've been on since 2018, you know, with the exception of what feels like no more than 5 starts in 4 years where it hasn't been great. And the thing I love about deGrom, kind of playing off of something Mike said about Harvey, about humility, it's not so much humility, because I think deGrom knows, you know, how good he is. He doesn't say aw shucks when he's asked about winning awards or whatever, but he's not impressed with it. And he's, you know, the one guy who is not going to get all excited about Jacob deGrom when he's asked about himself. And when he's asked about a 0.62 ERA, he says in so many words, I don't think about that, which is the correct answer. Not from an image standpoint or anything like that. Just, you know, he's got games to pitch. He's got innings to pitch and outs to get, and that's what he's all about, which, you know, every pitcher is all about. But, let others paint these portraits of greatness, or, you know, interpret it, shall I say. You know, the greatness is on the mound every time he's out there. And there's just not, you know, I'm not going to come on a podcast and say there's nothing left to say, because then they'll just be dead air. But, all we can do at this point is not, you know, I want to say, you know, not overdo it, but he seems immune to that sort of thing. And it's just, it's so businesslike at this point. Not boring by any means, because sometimes that can sound as if, it's just some dull, you know, a dull bee, to use another Odd Couple phrase, the name drone. He's not that at all. These are scintillating starts, but there's no, you know, it's not shocking. it's just, you know, fantastic. And, you know, we get to watch it, you know, from a veritable front row seat. I mean, anybody conceivably could watch it, but they're watching it be, as a pitcher on this other team. We're watching as a pitcher on our team. And, you know, again, always that caveat, and we, you know, saw it for a 10-day injured list span this year, as long as he stays healthy. This is great. This is one guy, and one guy you don't have to worry about, and as long as somebody scores him a run or two, it's a game you don't have to worry about for the most part. And it's just, you know, fantastic to watch. Fantastic to watch him work. Fantastic to, you know, watch him take a curveball out of his pocket that he hasn't thrown all year, and he's throwing it for strikes. I must have the sense in his last start against San Diego that, I'm not going to say he put 3 guys on. One of them, I think it was on an error. But it's like, well, you know, he needs a challenge maybe. He's going to, he's going to leave runners on base, leave runners in scoring position, because we are reminded, oh, yeah, that's his thing also, that this is the guy who has this incredible batting average against, somewhere in the zeros for runners in scoring position. We forget that because he doesn't put runners in scoring position. So, and I think the fantastic thing at the moment, I mean, the very up-to-date part of it is, he's been ramping up again since he spent the time on the injured list. He's saying, you could kind of see where he didn't want to pitch the extra inning
last week, but he's finding his way back from the hip tightness or the right side of his body. He knows himself well, and it just feels like it's, you know, he's been careful for three starts, and now he's back in business. It's quite a business to be in. So, I'm at a point, honestly, because every time he starts, and I have the privilege of writing about one of his starts, I always kind of groan a little bit when somebody leaves a comment like, oh, this is that I saw Goodman, this is even better, or I go back to see it was even better. And I used the headline early this year after that 15-strikeout game, the incomparable Jacob deGrom. And I don't want to compare him to anybody. I don't want to, you know, trot out these names that I already just cited. It's not, there's no point to it. Right now his only competition is Jacob deGrom and, you know, the hitters to the extent that they pose any kind of competitive challenge. Because, you know, I've been watching this team for more than 50 years. And, you know, I can trust me when I say I've seen everybody, and I've never seen anybody like this in a Mets uniform doing what he's been doing at this level every single start. It's fantastic. And, yeah, it's, you know, we've got the word for it, deGromination. And it's apt. If anything, it's understated, much like Jacob himself.
That it is. You are listening to the Metsian podcast, and we are so thankful that you have been. Big homestand coming up. Let's go Mets against the Padres and against the Cubs. But we are going to go all the way back to 1978 now. And I'll start with you, Mike, here. On Saturday, April 22nd, they beat the Cubs in Wrigley Field, going up 0.5. Skip Lockwood, our friend Skip Lockwood, got the save. Friday, June 9th, they beat the San Francisco Giants to go 27-30. Lockwood actually got the win in that game. And I had another game lined up, but I actually just lost it. But, you know, needless to say, at some point, oh, yeah, here we go. They won five in a row to complete that fifth in a row Saturday, July 22nd against the Braves. But unfortunately, at that time, that fifth in a row only brought them to be 43-56. The 1978 New York Mets, very famous for bubblegum blowing contest that Bobby Valentine won, but not famous for much else.
Not at all. The stress is finally starting to settle in after 77, the trading of Tom Seaver and Dave Kingman. 77, you know, a lot of us were still in shock. But in 1978, we, you know, physically recovered, and now the stress has taken a toll on us. It was a real struggle to watch Jerry Kuzman suffer and struggle the way he did. You know, there's a part of me that says that team should have done better. But the problem is that the Phillies and the Pirates were so good. They were stacked, and we had no business competing with them. But I look at the roster at a lot of players that, you know, we came to really appreciate growing up with, you know, and still they remain some of my favorite players to speak of. I think of them fondly. John Stearns is one of my favorite players of all time. Willie Montanez was a character. He really was. And he put in a good season for the Mets. You know, but again, getting back to the favorites, you know, Lee Mazzilli. I think Joe Youngblood was a big favorite. As a matter of fact, I'm contemplating getting a jersey made for him. Craig Swan won the ERA title. So there was things to speak of, but this was starting to get really, really stressful, you know, on the heels of 77, big disappointment, especially for me. You know how highly I thought of 76. And, you know, the crosstown Yankees, well, now they became a real big problem. You know, they won the pennant in 76. 77, they won the crown. And in 78, they repeat. But when Tom Seaver was still around, none of that mattered. He was our guy. He was our representative. He was our comeback to any kind of Yankee talk. And when Seaver left, we lost that. And then the Yankees, you know, they got really good and we got really bad. Extremes. You know, 90-plus victories for the Yankees and 90-plus losses for the Mets. So, again, this was the beginning of a very stressful time, especially for us youngsters, us kids. But, again, here I am now in my 50s, and I look back so fondly on your John Stearns's and your Lee Mazzilli's and your Joel Youngblood's and even Craig Swan. But the overriding sentiment of 78 for me was, you know, having to watch Jerry Kuzman struggle so much, so badly. Unfortunate. Take it away.
Well, Greg, when you look at this roster, let's start with the offense. There's not one player, whether it's the bench or the starting lineup, or even really the best we got is Roy Lee Jackson, age 24, playing four games with only three plate appearances, hitting .667. That's the best we have. Maybe Butch Benton hitting .500 in two at-bats, four at-bats.
You're cherry picking a little bit there. Listen, you started this on a very high note for me. You referenced the game in April. They went into first place. There was a back page headline. It was not, from all I could tell, it was not ironic. It was not mocking. It said, Mets take first, Cubs. And I clipped that headline out of the Daily News from that Sunday. I taped it to my closet door, and it stayed on my closet door for about a dozen years until, like, my father sold the house. I had to come in, clean things out. That's how much that start in 78 meant to me. I mean, 78 was at least, as we entered it, it felt like a fresh start. After 77, which was such a miserable year, they did a lot of house cleaning, or whatever you want to call it, after 77. Not that they hadn't done enough in 77, but, you're suddenly looking at Ken Henderson, who was a veteran outfielder, and you'd brought in Tom Grieve, you'd brought in Willie Montanez, Tim Foley had come back. And the thing that I really that differentiates 78 to me from everything that had come before is they changed the uniform, one of the lesser talked about uniforms for those who focus on those things. When you see pictures from that era, the little orange and blue piping around the sleeves. Not the racing stripe that would be made famous in, circa 1986, but the collar and the cuffs, as they might say. And that was new. And you can always tell when a game was from 1978 when you see a picture or video or film clips, because there's no name on the back, because that wouldn't be out until 79. And they felt like a fresh team in April. You had the new guys. You had a successful start. Jerry Kuzman, who only won three games the whole year, one of them was opening day. Jerry Kuzman had never pitched opening day. He was, they had Tom Seaver to do that. So Ed Kringle hits a walk-off home run early in the year off the bench. Things are happening. Ken Henderson, I just mentioned, it plays this outsized role in my mind because he got off to this fantastic start, got injured, and you never heard from him again. But I can still hear Bob Murphy
going on about the Henderson men, because both Steve Henderson and Ken Henderson had driven in runs that first weekend. And it was, you know, again, dawning of a new era. You know, that spring, all the talk in the papers, the optimistic talk was, you know, the Mets could finish in fourth place. That was the optimism. You know, fourth place didn't get you anything, mind you, in the 16 division in a pre-wild card world. But the idea that the Mets, who had finished in sixth place in the 16 division, could finish ahead of two teams was mind-boggling. And, you know, that I carry that into the season. And they get off to this 9-6 start, this Mets take first place wonderland. And, you know, it's really, that carried me pretty much into the summer. If you're, you know, exploring Baseball Reference right now, Sam, you know, you'll see there's a moment in late May. The Mets get to 23-24. I'm not even looking it up, so I'll never forget this. They won the first game of a Memorial Day doubleheader, twilight doubleheader, and it's like, oh boy, they are going to be 500. Except Silvio Martinez one hits them from St. Louis, and they never quite get anywhere near 500 again. And I think ultimately what happens to the Mets in 1978, at least in terms of my perception and perhaps everybody's perception who was on the ground at the time, on August 10th, 1978, a newspaper strike comes to New York, and there is no coverage in the city of the Mets. You know, you have your Newsday on Long Island, and you have your Jersey papers and so forth. And there were some what they called strike papers, but I remember the strike papers would have like two-day-old wire copy. It just felt like the Mets had completely disappeared, unless you tuned in to Channel 9 or put on WMCA, you had no idea the Mets existed. And to whatever extent they were covered on the local news, it was very much in the shadows of what Mike said. There was this. Not just that the Yankees were, you know, on their way to a world championship after having won the world championship, it's that they were coming from 14 games behind to overtake the Red Sox. And I'll tell you that was the summer I, you know, again, it was just one of those other league flirtations. I was very much into the Red Sox that summer as they built up a 14-game lead on the Yankees. And I think every Mets fan of that era had a Red Sox flirtation at some point once they realized that they were the anti-Yankees, and I certainly did. And I walked around town where I lived in a Red Sox cap. You want to call it front running, that's fine. I just needed a diversion. Didn't stop rooting for the Mets or watching the Mets, but I kept one eye on the American League East, and that gave me, you know, license to suffer and understand what Red Sox fans talk about. But, you know, from a Mets standpoint, unless you were paying super close attention to things like John Stern setting the record for most steals by a catcher, which is one of those records you had no idea existed until John Stearns broke it. And, of course, you know, Craig Swan going for that ERA title and things like that. Willie Montanez, almost 100 RBIs, came within, the record was 105 at the time with Rusty. But he came in one behind Don Clendenin, so it was third most in Mets history. So these things you latched on to, and, you know, you just hope for a better day because, you know, all the promise, the new uniforms, the new players, it all dissipated in the middle of the summer, and then it just faded because nobody was covering it. And it turned out to be, you know, 78 gets lumped in there pretty easily with 77 and 79 because the records are very similar. The personnel is, you know, for the most part, the core of it is the same. But to me, it was a little more exciting in spots. And let me just leave with one final thought. As Howie Rose is fond of talking about having been 15 years old in 1969 and saying that, well, you know, 15 years old is the perfect time for, you know, to be a baseball fan. And your team is winning, and, you know, because, you know, you're aware enough, you know enough, but, you know, you're not saddled with adult responsibilities, and nothing matters more than your team. Well, I was 15 in 1978, and there was nothing being a 15-year-old Mets fan except for what you made of it. And, you know, you were – to be a Mets fan in that summer, you know, it was a DIY proposition. You had to do it yourself. You know, if you knew anybody else who was a Mets fan, then the two of you would huddle together and try to find beauty and elegance in these small steps that the Mazzillis and the Youngbloods and the Hendersons and the Stearnses and whoever you care to name were achieving. And yes, Bobby Valentine, utility man and bubble-blowing champion of the 1978 Mets. so it was a you've obviously watched your Mets yearbooks, and that was a great Mets yearbook. It was a much better Mets yearbook than it was a Mets season, sadly. But, you know, it's one of those seasons, baby. We've lived through variations on the theme so many times. This was when, you know, people like Mike and me were kind of not by choice getting used to it. You know, we weren't around for the 120 and 110 loss type of seasons in the 60s. This was our indoctrination into how life sometimes worked. And, you know, the moral to all of this, then, you know, if you've maintained the theme as you count off your episodes for episodes 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, you know, it made the stuff that came after so much sweeter than could possibly be understood. You know, this was the early days of signing free agents and making yourself a contender, at least in theory. The Mets, of course, didn't do that because they were at the nadir of, you know, ownership at the time. The last year of, well, they still had a little more nadir to go, I suppose, in 79. But, you know, this was, we signed free agents that year. We signed Tom Houseman, Elliot Maddox, who were on nobody's radar, but they were professional players who gave the Mets some good moments. But what I'm saying here is that you couldn't just, or, you know, up to that point, you couldn't just go out and say, oh, I'm going to go get Carlos Beltran and Pedro Martinez, and we're going to go from being a really bad team to a pretty good team. In 1978, you just sort of put up with the bad team, and that was life. and if you didn't, you know what? If you didn't hop off in 77, if you didn't say on the morning of June 16th, what am I doing with this team? Why don't I just go root for this other team that has signed free agents and is doing wonderful things? Well, you weren't going to leave in 78, and you were going to see how this thing played out. And that's what we did. And, you know, when I say, oh, yeah, you know, it was sweeter because we did, it was worth it. Well, you know, we waited a while. And... you know, I talked about being 15 years old. Well, when you're 15 years old, you know, you don't find a lot of peers who say, hey, good for you for being a loyal fan, and I don't root for your team, but I respect that you do. No, it doesn't work like that at all. All you're hearing about is how much your team sucks and how much you suck. But again, you know, if you didn't get out in 77, you weren't going to get out in 78. So, you know, Bobby Valentine blew that bubble. And, you know, in our minds, the bubble never burst because, you know, we were incapable of having the bubble burst as Mets fans. We knew what we had. And they did not finish in fourth place, despite all that springtime optimism that they wouldn't be the worst team in the division, because they were.
Bucky Dent, right? Just needed to cap that off. Mike, you know, looking at this, I mean, Greg is absolutely right. Looking like they could be 500 at 24-24, going up against the St. Louis Cardinals in the night bill. Unfortunately, they lost 6-2 in 10 innings, where in the top of the 10th, St. Louis scored 4. After only scoring 1 in the second, Mets took the lead in the third, but then Cardinals tied in the 6th. Mike, let me ask you this. I'm going to put it back over to you with some trivia. Two people in this game for St. Louis got three hits against the New York Mets. Who are they? 1978.
In the 10-inning loss? I'm going to assume without looking, I'm going to assume one of them is Keith Hernandez, if you're asking this.
Mike, how about you?
I'd agree with that. Yeah, Keith Hernandez.
All right, we got one. Anybody want to take a poke at the other on this really bad St. Louis Cardinals team in 1978?
Ken Reed.
Oh, God, they were bad. I'm not looking at the box score, to be honest, so I'm not guessing. But, God, they were 16-32. Oh, my God. And they ended up,
yes.
That's right, the Mets were holding fifth place for a very long time that year. And then finally, they couldn't do it. They could do no more. Well, we see
George
that,
Hendrick in center field.
George Hendrick, yeah, they both had
three hits.
Future Met Gary Templeton had a couple of hits when he was kind of an up-and-comer. Future Met Jerry Morales had a hit. And future Met Pete Falcone. Let me tell you something about Pete Falcone. The one pitcher the Mets consistently beat in those years was Pete Falcone. They had a 9-0 record against him. So what do? They go out and get him.
They trade for him.
Like, Tom Green for Pete Falcone. And I was just like, why are we bringing in the one guy we can beat consistently? And, he didn't go 9-0 against anybody as a Met. But he was from Brooklyn. He was Joe Pignatano's cousin. And if you don't think that was mentioned every single broadcast, in those days, as we celebrate so many things Brooklyn, you had to love the 78 Mets or 79 Mets of Torrey and Pignatano and Mazzilli and Falcone. And I think I'm leaving somebody out. A lot of guys from the old neighborhood. And, didn't help. It was
so the day that Pete Falcone was born, the Dodgers beat the Yankees to go up. Well, no, they were down 2-0 in the 1953 World Series, but game three, was this at Ebbets Field? But this is the day that Pete Falcone was born in Brooklyn, New York. That was going on, the 1953 World Series. Interesting time to be born in Brooklyn, for sure.
Product of Lafayette High School.
Oh, and a year after a photo that I tweeted the other day of Sandy Koufax playing on the Lafayette High School basketball team, which I thought was apropos with the playoffs in Brooklyn going on. Mike, take us home with 1978.
That's it. Not much more to say. Actually, there's a lot more to say because my aunts and uncles were teaching me to be a National League fan. No, really. I was encompassing all my fandom was being spread throughout National League. I became a big Willie Stargell fan during those years. I remember it like yesterday, Pittsburgh coming in for a doubleheader. Him, Dave Parker, Bill Robinson, Madlock, just pounding us. But being able to see a lot of players in the mid to late 70s that they're still my, childhood heroes today, like Joe Morgan, Willie Stargell. I appreciated when these players came to town. So there was that. I wasn't this depressed kid at Shea Stadium watching my Mets get pounded out every day. There was appreciation for the competition and other teams there. Appreciated watching Steve Carlton every so often when he pitched at Shea. You understand? So, and I've always appreciated being in New York and having two teams and being able to go to Yankee Stadium and see twice as more baseball than, say, somebody in a city with no team or one team. So I've always, since a little kid, my aunts and uncles, they're the ones that taught me how to keep score. That's where I got my education on Willie Mays. That's where I got my education on Roberto Clemente, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So This just followed suit. I loved being there. We were going to a lot of games in the late 70s. So that's why it was such a weird transition from those mid-years, 74, 75, 76, towards the late years. You know, that was a drastic transition from, you know, the winners of 69 and 73 that we were still able to see and behold for those last couple of years. And then, you know, we headed into the dark years, and it was what it was, transition. But change is inevitable. And you learn that. And as a Met fan, a young Met fan, let's just say we learned that the hard way, which is good, I think. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
And I have to make a redaction. On October 1st, 1953, the New York Yankees beat the Brooklyn Dodgers at Yankee Stadium, beating Preacher Rowe. And I was about to say his name, but I have to make Ed Lopat one for the New York Yankees. But wrapping up with 1978, I will honestly, I'm going to make it my final word that I urge the new ownership, I urge the new regime of the New York Mets to consider that if we're going to buy that stupid swoosh from 1993, then I would gladly buy a 1978 New York Mets Snow White pinstripe pullover with Stearns on the back. Well, of course, no names, and I'd have to look up exactly. Greg, what number was John Stearns in 1978 without the name?
He was number 12.
Thank you. So for maybe I would just to go with my The Dude jersey, I will just make The Dude jersey number 12, but probably not. I'll just keep it number 12. But honestly, we will buy anything as Mets fans. Doesn't matter whether it was during a losing season. That is my favorite New York. That is my favorite Mets jersey of all time, is the 1978 Snow White pinstripe pullover. I urge the new regime or just Ebbets Field Flannels or Mitchell and Ness, somebody out there, make this jersey for me. Please make this jersey for me. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Metsian Podcast. We are so thankful that you do. Before we go, I'm going to send it over to Greg Prince, not only for his final word, but before you do that, Greg, please tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find me at faithandfearandflushing.com, as you were kind enough to introduce me at the beginning, blogging every game of every season since 2005, Jason Fry and myself, and at Greg_Prince on Twitter. And you want to check out Greg W. Prince on Amazon for some books about the Mets, that would be swell too. I realize I promised on Twitter to invoke Marty Cornejo, so I feel his name has now been invoked. Closer for the 1978 Mets in the early going. Skip Lockwood indeed took over as expected, but Marty Cornejo came out of nowhere, got the job out of spring training, got three wins very early, wore number 47, which I bring up only because to this day you say, quick, number 47 for the Mets, and while a normal person would say Jesse Orozco or an evil person would say Tom Glavine, I would say Marty Cornejo probably. Just, I don't know why. Marty the Chief Cornejo sticks with me. Him and Mike Brewer, number 26, also made the team with no warning, and then they both disappeared. Final word. You know what? When you said Marty Cornejo, you've said it all. So thank you for the opportunity to wallow in 1978 to the 66 wins, try to overlook the 96 losses, to Pat Zachary, our only All-Star from 1978. And, you know, better days came. And here's to Metsian Podcast and the 78 episodes in the can.
78 official episodes in the can. May we put off 79 as long as possible, right? So we'll talk about that when the time comes. Greg, as always, thank you so much. I will just say, you know, because usually we do this the opposite. Whenever I am not hosting, I usually get the last word and then a let's go Mets, but I'm going to put that off to my compadre in a moment. But I just wanted to say, in terms of what's coming up, I think this is a brilliant test for the Mets right now. San Diego at home, followed by the Cubs at home as well. One first place team, another that is right there and is probably going to prevent the rest of the National League from getting into the playoffs if the West continues on this trek. So let's bring it on. Let's keep the good juju going with this 2021 New York Mets and this new era of Mets baseball. And without further ado, let me pass it on to the Brooklyn Trolley blogger himself, Michael Collant, to take us out. Mike.
Well, on that note, let's go Mets. Let's go Nets, who seem to be taking a lead in this evening's playoff game against the Bucks.
Up one late in the third quarter.
That is correct, sir. So let's go Mets. Let's go Nets. Greg, it's been a pleasure talking Mets baseball with you again.
Thank you.
That is my final word. That being said, great. Thank you for your time this evening. Very, very much, sir. Always much appreciated on our part.
Happy to be here, guys.
And with that said, let's go Mets, everybody. Thank you for taking time out and listening to the podcast. Like, subscribe, do all that good stuff. Give us a review. Tell us what we're doing wrong, and we'll try to make it better. In the meantime, hey, nothing happens if you don't take the swing. That's my advice. Let's go Mets. Good night, everyone.
Let's go Mets. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Mike. Take care, everybody. Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Go Mets.